Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio. Fresh tape. Proceed.
Oh, Miss Turner. Where were you born? Just a little biography on this first.
I was born in Chicago, Illinois.
And I understand you educated part in Berlin, is that right?
That's correct. After completing my undergraduate training at Oberlin College, I spent 1 year at the Free University of West Berlin.
And you're a German teacher by profession, is that right?
That's right.
Had you studied German at Oberlin?
Yes, I had. I was a German major at Oberlin.
Yes. Let's see now how you're doing. Maybe a little closer will help.
Mm-hmm.
How did you happen to go to Germany?
Well, I received a German government grant from the German government upon graduation from Oberlin.
Just for the purpose of studying?
For the purpose of studying, yes.
Then you came here to Cleveland to teach in the local schools?
Well, not directly. I spent 1 year after returning from Germany at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, where I received a Master of Arts in Teaching.
And then out here.
And then out here.
Tell me about how you came to leave teaching and to devote yourself fully to the work of CORE. Is this a long process or a sudden decision? How did it come about?
Well, I was the chairman of the chapter here in Cleveland from November 1962 to June 1963. The events in Birmingham brought about a rather sudden decision. I felt after what occurred there that I could no longer continue teaching German at a time like this, and began looking for ways in which to work in the civil rights movement on a full-time basis.
But you had been, connected to CORE for some time before that.
Yes, I had been. I was chairman here in Cleveland, and I was also working with CORE in Boston.
How long back does that fact go, connection with CORE?
Connection with CORE as an organization goes back really to the year in Boston when I became involved. But I have been involved in civil rights organizations ever since being a teenager.
People I have talked to about the Cleveland situation, and some in Cleveland, are very pessimistic about the immediate future here. You want to talk about the local situation a bit?
Yes, I think
it's highly polarized now.
I think it is very unfortunate. We have a polarized community here by virtue of the fact that a vacuum has been created in the white community through apathy. That vacuum has been filled by people who would rather prevent the civil rights movement from achieving its goals. People in leadership positions, such as the president of the Board of Education, our mayor, who would rather scream communism than address themselves to the real grievances that lie behind the protest now. In view of the fact that they are the ones who have taken leadership and have organized around the principle of keeping down the movement and totally misunderstanding the movement, we have reached a point where I'm afraid the community is rather polarized. The outlook then for the immediate future looks a little bleak. However, for the long-range future, this may be a different story.
There is considerable white support within a certain segment. Isn't there the clergy here?
Yes, there is considerable white support. The clergy has come out very strongly in favor of the goals of the freedom movement. There is also considerable support in suburban communities, but our major problem is that the white community in Cleveland has seen only one way to express itself, and that is through misunderstanding the goals of the movement, and has received no leadership to help them understand the goals of the movement.
Now, in some cities, you find at least an uncommitted body of opinion that is more or less willing to approach matters practically, if not with high idealism.
Yes.
A kind of moderate or faintly liberal sentiment. which is malleable.
Yes.
But in those cities frequently you don't find any committed body of leadership in the church or in other organizations. Now here you have the reverse situation, don't you? How do you account for that?
Well, it is a bit strange. I don't know if you would consider it the reverse of that. We still have a large mass of uncommitted people.
Who are not polarized?
I think we do have a large number of people who are not polarized, or if given a second chance to rethink their position, would pull away from the polarization that's already taking place. I again feel that it is the function of the leadership in the white community. The only voices that have spoken out up to this point have been the voices which would help to polarize the community. I do not give up the white community for lost, however, because I feel that if other leadership spoke out, that many of those who find themselves on the other side of the fence could also find their way back over.
What is the role of the white liberal in the freedom movement? What is his function, position?
Because we have quite a bit of discussion about whether the people who are really involved in our movement are liberals. Think that perhaps another name is more appropriate.
All right.
We don't want to say
the nasty word for other people, is that it?
We would call them the white committed, and we feel that their role, as it has been exhibited in Cleveland, is a very strong supportive role. In many instances, a very strong leadership role in their own communities. There is a definite role for the white committed person, the person who is willing, as the Reverend Bruce Clunder was, to lay down his life for the cause in which he believed. There certainly is a role for that person.
You were present at that event, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I didn't see it, but I was at the scene at the time.
I understand that you did a great deal to try to quiet the mob sense after the event, the attack on the driver of the bulldozer.
Yes, well, that occurred around 3:30 or 4 when the construction had stopped and the policemen were attempting to send the mob home. We knew they were angry. They were justifiably angry. They had been provoked considerably by the actions of the police that day. And yet we felt that there was no cause to be served at that point by exploding there in the community. We attempted to quiet them and to send them home.
In the attack on the bulldozer driver, that occurred immediately, didn't it?
Yes, it did. And it was not a mass attack. There was one young man who became hysterical after seeing the Reverend Clunder run over.
Only one person was involved in the attack?
That's right, in a bodily attack. Now, there were sticks and stones thrown at the policeman, too. But in terms of actually attacking the driver, there was only one person involved in that.
That wasn't the way the press reported in some places, anyway.
No, it wasn't. Time magazine carried a deliberate distortion of that.
I saw a Time report, but you saw this with your own eyes.
I didn't see this with my own eyes. This is reported to me by eyewitnesses. There was one person who attacked the driver, a young man who went berserk after seeing, or temporarily at least, after seeing the death of Reverend Clunder.
Did any sticks or stones find their way to the driver?
Not to my knowledge, although I think most of the sticks and stones were thrown at the policeman.
Could you see a situation where this explosive violence, which you helped to stem, could serve a useful purpose?
Well, this is the whole purpose of the nonviolent demonstration and protest action. We try to channel the justifiably intense feelings of people who have gone through and lived under this system, try to channel them in ways which will be creative and will bring about constructive changes.
I notice again from Time magazine that Mr. Ely, Lawless Ely in New Orleans, with whom I've had conversations like this, too long in fact, now says if violence comes this summer, he would take no step to curb it in New Orleans.
Well, I think there's a point at which the curbing can no longer be done. I feel that it is primarily the job of law enforcement agencies to curb violence. This is a heavy responsibility for citizens. I feel that we should take those steps that we can. But I'm also realist enough to know that if wide-scale mob violence breaks out, that I will be would no longer be in a position to curb it. And I think this violence has to be seen as an expression of such tremendous discontent and an expression of tremendous frustrations that have built up over a long period of time, and no one person can stop them. I think it's too much to ask that one person attempt to stop them.
The other day I was talking to Mr. Stringfellow, whom you may or may not know or know about. He's white man, very much interested in and committed to the freedom movement. He says, in predicting violence in Harlem this summer, that the white man's role is to accept it, to put his hands down and take the brickbat or the knife or whatever it is. He takes a totally. I say, what about the cops then? What should they do? What should the cops do in that case?
Well, unfortunately, the policemen, if they behave in other places like they do here, are also unfortunate tools of a power structure which has failed to understand the dynamics of the protests, and consequently not understanding anything about the people with whom they deal, not been able to deal with the situation in any kind of constructive way. That's why police brutality takes place, and of course police brutality breeds more violence. I feel that clearly at some point the policemen are to step in to prevent loss of life in them, but they should not be there to prevent a one-sided loss of life in them, as has been the case. An example here is that on Murray Hill, where a mob rioted out of control, a white mob, I mean, let me say, police made no attempt whatsoever to curb them, permitted them to riot, refused to take horses there because they said it would incite the mob to more violence. And yet, on the Lakeview site, with a smaller number of people, they did use their horses, they charged the crowd, and again, did what they said they couldn't do elsewhere.
Tell me this, what is the ethnic situation aside from the Negro-white collisions that have occurred here? Mm-hmm. There's some talk that there are other ethnic complications involved in these collisions besides the Negro-white. But the Italian section is involved, that the Poles are involved. Can you give me a breakdown on that?
Well, this is quite true, that we have in Cleveland ethnic pockets in the city of Cleveland, which jealously guard their own traditions, their own way of doing things. Often this way of doing things runs counter to the mood and the progress of the entire community. And this, of course, complicates the situation. But I don't think it can be said that these people are responsible for the kind of violence that takes place. I think white ordinary Americans who don't belong to ethnic groups will respond in the same way if challenged.
If challenged, but the challenge now is primarily to, say, the Polish pockets and the Italian pockets?
Through the education issue, the challenge has been primarily at these ethnic pockets, that's correct.
Is this an unfortunate fact, you think, that has to be dealt with, or would there be ways of avoiding this collision with these special, highly homogeneous groups?
There would be ways of colliding only with them. If the commitment of the school board at this point was to citywide integration and to implementing those plans to bring it about, I don't think that these ethnic groups would feel as though they were selected or isolated. That this would be something that would involve the West Side as well.
They feel that they are isolated and must protect themselves. They're being discriminated against, too. Is that right?
I guess that's their feeling, yes. I think there's a real strong in-group, out-group feeling there.
What do you think of the theory which some sociologists present that as an ethnic minority achieves equality, mm-hmm. the tendency is not to bleed off into the surrounding society but come back together?
Yeah, I'm not a real student of sociology, although I'm acquainted with that theory. that may be true. It has worked in certain instances with the Jewish community. I think it has worked here in Cleveland with certain elements of the Italian
observation here.
And Polish communities, yes.
Would that work with the Negro, you think?
We've never had an opportunity to find out.
No.
Because
you must have some suppositions about it, though.
Yeah, well, my supposition is that it may very well be true that if all the barriers were lifted, that Negroes, after having the experience of equal opportunity, would still choose to live together.
There would be nothing to prove.
No, that's right. But I think that the protest here is in the fact that equal opportunity is very much restricted by denying them that opportunity, the opportunity to break out of the ghetto. That's pretty obvious. Because when Negroes are consolidated in the ghetto, they are more easily exploited, they are more easily mistreated and overlooked by this powers that be. And this is why inferior education, housing, and employment opportunities are realities in the ghetto situation.
What's the Negro vote like in Cleveland? How much registration is there here?
There's more registration than actual voting, and there's not enough registration. That's one of our programs for the summer, to register more voters and to begin to make our political power felt.
What is the ratio, roughly, population to registration here? As potential registration population and actual registration, what's the ratio?
I wouldn't be qualified to answer that with any real certainty. I know that there certainly aren't the numbers registered that could be. This is what our job is, to make sure that that full potential is realized. I couldn't say.
How much trouble do you have with Negro apathy?
We have...
One, about voting. Two, about civil rights in general.
The apathy towards civil rights is being broken down. I think the very fact that we had a 92% effective boycott, school boycott here in Cleveland on April the 20th, points up that the Negro community can be brought out of apathy and is, in fact, less apathetic than the white community. Now, in terms of translating that kind of involvement on the civil rights issue into a political issue, that's going to take new organization, that's going to take a new approach to the community. We have to help them to translate into the political arena. But I feel that the problem with apathy in the community is not so, it doesn't reside so much with the Negro community, it resides with the white community.
In general, let's say that's true. But there is the tale you hear everywhere from Negroes when they are speaking in sort of an unbuttoned way, that apathy is a great problem.
Surely it is. Surely it is. But I
there are many different reasons for that.
That's right. It's quite understandable to me that a person who has to worry, as most of the people here in Huff have to worry, about where the next meal and where the next rent payment is coming from, have little time left over to concern themselves with the rights of other men. I think this is a matter of economic deprivation. And some of that will not be able to be overcome. The society has created it. But at the same time, I'm encouraged by the fact that we can communicate with 92% of the Negro parents to get them to keep their children out of school. This shows to me that the apathy can be broken down. And we're going to do it.
Isn't it strange to you, as it is to me offhand, that Tennessee, Memphis, the capital of the Mississippi Delta, cotton country, have a very highly organized Negro vote that's very effective as a bargaining basis that Nashville has and Cleveland does not have? Mm-hmm. How would you account for that?
I would account for that in the following way. I think that the entire Negro community in Memphis was forced to learn the brutal facts of segregation through civil rights demonstrations long before the entire community of Cleveland was. Cleveland has always been known as a citadel of tokenism. It's always been the place where people thought they were doing all right, and unless you have concrete evidence to the contrary, you'd like to believe that. Now, we have given them concrete evidence to the contrary in the last few months. In the last few months, there's been a lot more awareness in the Negro community. that police brutality does in fact exist. If they see it on television, you know, they know it individually. But now the whole community has a chance to be reminded of it. I think that the fact that we now have a movement here in Cleveland, at least the beginnings of it, is going to make a difference of, in terms of our political organization.
Was there ever a kind of Negro vote here which could be delivered to one political party?
Surely, surely. That's been the pattern. In fact, it's a pattern in most northern cities, that the Negro was organized politically all right, but he was organized by the machine. And the machine delivered the votes, and no one ever challenged that. Now, we're challenging that. We're asking the community now to act as an independent body and use their vote.
But wasn't that machine an education in the use of the vote?
Beg your pardon?
Wasn't that political machine that delivered the Negro vote an education in voting, in the power of the ballot?
No, not really, because it was not used in an independent way. It was... The machine, in a sense, was used by certain individuals to give individual benefits. It has not been used as a voice of the community, but of the entire community. In other words, there's another problem here that we have to consider, too, and that is the machine in the North has been misleading because it was dominated by Negroes. In other words, it was easier to be fooled by thinking that these people were actually delivering the vote for the Negro community when it was not. Just to explain again what I mean by misleading, even though the machine here is white dominated, the Negro community could and was easily fooled by the fact that the Negroes still seemed to be in prominence. We had Negro councilmen, we had Negro judges, and consequently it looked as though the Negro vote was being delivered for Negro purposes, when in fact it's the same kind of maneuvering that went on in the South, one step removed. In other words, I think it's going to require a good deal more organization in the North to break down the pattern than it did in the South, where the racial lines were so much more obvious.
Do you know anything about the relation of the father of Martin Luther King, the President Jr., to this whole question of power?
No, I don't.
Power.
No, I don't.
I wondered if you did. And I don't know what I know. I know, you know, it's... Dr. King says his father stood in an intermediate position in the historical development, you see. That's the way he would put it, as a stage in this development. That leads to the matter of, say, development. How would you describe the stages of development in the Negro life vis-a-vis white life, white society, since the Civil War? Do you see clearly defined stages? Or is it more of the same, more of the same?
No, it's not more of the same. I think we have now a generation which is markedly different from the generation which preceded it. And in that sense, I can talk about my father, who was a hard worker, but who struggled to raise a family of five. And in fact, was so engaged in the struggle of survival that he could not give his attention to the problems which he felt very deeply and met every day, and yet in an organized way couldn't do anything about it. He was not free to do so. But he made it possible for me, gave me the equipment, made sure that I had the equipment, to begin to do something about these problems. And I think this is true of many of us in this generation. There's a certain backlog of security which our parents did not have by virtue of their parents really having the scuffle, which enables us, a certain backlog of security and self-confidence, let me say, that enables us to tackle the problem in a much more general way than our parents were able to do so.
In the 1930s, there was great provocation, poverty and distress and oppressions for the Negro, plus the crisis of the Depression. Why no freedom movement then? Why did it wait 30 years or 25 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I'm a great believer that the history is created by the times and the individuals who live in those times. I feel that one of the reasons, maybe, and this is just speculation, is that the entire country was in something of the similar situation in the 30s at least. That maybe it wasn't quite so easy to distinguish between the suffering of blacks and the suffering of whites as expressed in the labor movement. I don't know. This is just a possibility. Of course, the blacks have always suffered independently, and much more so than anyone else.
Well, as a leadership in the 30s, Negro leadership.
Yeah, I believe it was channeled pretty much in the labor movement, and therefore was not fighting a black battle per se. It was fighting a labor battle, which in a sense sort of distracted from the strength of a Negro community.
But the Negroes were even farther outside the labor movement then than they are now.
Right, but they were making some kind of gains. CIO was forming, they were beginning in the 30s, that's not true, in the 40s, I guess it's more true. Actually, I just should let Dave answer that, because he's a student of history, and I'm not.
What I'm getting at is this, Ms. Turner.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to leave the question of process, the sense of historical process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people, if asked about freedom now, will say now.
Yes.
All will say in the past, we were always, but it was only an accident. It didn't happen 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
No, it's not a matter of accident.
Not a matter of accident.
No, it's not. The real combination of factors, though, I can't spell out. I really haven't given enough attention to it, but I don't believe it was an accident.
Let me try this as one factor. 30 years ago, there was not enough educated leadership among Negroes.
That's true. That's sort of what I hit on when I said that my father was not able, was not in a position to remove himself from his own struggle for survival and think in terms of a general struggle. He didn't have the equipment.
You must be aware that if I should say that to many Negroes, they'd be very angry.
I imagine so. But I think it's
realistic. I can justify that.
Yeah. I think it's a realistic appraisal, though.
They would be angry because it seems to imply that process means time. You see, and freedom now is outside of time, now. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
How do you interpret freedom now in the light of your previous basis to process?
Shut it off a minute, let me go.
About freedom now, Miss Turner.
Yeah, well, freedom now, and this is perhaps one of the most frustrating experiences of someone who's committed to it, is to a certain extent relative. I would say it is less relative now than it would have been 20 years ago. Freedom now probably was the slogan of many people in the 30s. And yet there were certain conditions, certain factors which prohibited that from becoming a reality, and we might just talk about them again. Some of the relevant ones, at least. I pointed to the idea that self-confidence seems to be the mark of the present leadership. An intense pride in being black. This was not the case 20 years ago, and I think it is very correctly assessed to be the result of the African and Asian revolutions.
Let me take a point there and go off on a sidetrack. Speaking of pride of being black, Du Bois and other Negro writers have talked about the psychic split of the Negro in America, the pull toward the mystique noir, the pull toward Africanism, the pull toward even the American Negro tradition as opposed to the Judeo-Christian white Western European tradition. A real split.
Yes.
You feel this split, an impulse?
Yes.
You do?
I do.
How do you deal with it?
It doesn't present any problem to me, because I think that by drawing on both traditions, I think I have broadened horizons for me. I'm an American, and therefore, of course, share in the Judeo-Christian Western civilization, but I'm also aware of the fact that I share in another civilization, which I think broadens me and broadens other people in the movement. We have the strength of belonging to two communities, in a sense, and they complement each other.
What about these Italians down the street?
That
you were deploring a few minutes ago.
No, I wasn't really deploring them. I feel that...
Can you hang on a minute? I better change this table.
Yeah, sure.